night.
Russell.
Oh yeah, all of that. Hey. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be here. You'll have to excuse me if I cough a little or something during the meeting. I'm a little, got something, whatever's going around. But I just really so much enjoyed. Well, first of all, I like this group. First of all, you're all so good looking and young, you know, and, you know, except for me and where's Jimmy? Probably had to go get his blood pressure taken or something. I mean, really, I got shoes older than most of you. So the ones I'm wearing right now, and you guys are. And I love it. It's like birthday night. I love listening. It's perfect. We're on the 11th step tonight. It's perfect. I loved. Was it Paige up here? The young lady who introduced Paige. She said she does the deal. Does the deal. I know what that means. She does the deal. And Marilyn, I really. I so much appreciate your talk, and everybody else appreciated seeing Brad and Dan and all the celebrants. It's just great. It's just a wonderful thing. I wish for everybody here. You know, you hear, you know, when I went to law school, they said look to your right and look to your left. One of those people won't be here, you know, next year, and they were right about that. And I've always been told, and I've seen for myself, that there's sort of like a winnowing process in AA. I mean, it's just factually true. It's sad, but true. You fall in love with people. You love them. You know, you want them. You, no matter how much you want somebody to get sober and get this thing, your wanting ain't going to do it. Your wanting ain't going to do it. You know, and sometimes, and this gets kind of crazy, their wanting sometimes doesn't do it. I mean, I've sponsored guys that really want this thing. And they can't do it. It doesn't happen. I've seen it happen. You know, I remember once I was watching some sort of documentary, you know, about these turtles in Florida up the beach somewhere. I don't know what beach it is. You guys probably know what it is. Where they come on the sand and they bury their eggs. And they bury maybe like 100 eggs or something. Large amount of eggs. Tortoises. And at a certain time during the year, the eggs hatch. And like 100 of Lily's turtlings or tortoises or whatever, they come running out of these things, you know. And the way the documentary was, one of these National Geographic things where they hang out on the beach and they sort of film it at night. And these little suckers run along the beach, and the birds, you know, they got these birds there. They're flying down and they're like picking these things up and eating them, and they're all like being decimated. And like out of hundreds, like three make it into the water. And then of the three that make it in the water, two get eaten by fish. It's like one, make it, you know, and sort of like Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and many are called, but few are chosen. That's what I was told when I first came in. I had a sponsor that, I've had three sponsors. You know how people say, well, you've been my temporary sponsor? I don't know how to make it permanent. You know, my first sponsor died of cancer in my arms, really somewhere in a hospice up here when I was about, you know, 10 years sober. And that was Bob. And my second sponsor was Joe Snyder, and he was my sponsor for about 7-8 years. You know, I'm not sure of the time period. And he also died of cancer and emphysema. And then my third sponsor, the sponsor I have now, is 57 years, and it's John. And both Joe and John used to quote scripture to me all the time. Mostly John, because he's a Baptist preacher, you know, he likes doing that stuff. But Joe used to love to quote to me. I'd go up to him and I'd have problems. Any of you guys have sponsors? Yeah, any of you guys, anybody you guys ever have anxiety? You're laughing, you don't know what it's like, you know. I would have like anxiety over stuff, you know, things, you know, life and, you know. You know, some people need an excuse to drink. I didn't need an excuse. Awake was good enough for me, you know. Just being around on the planet was good enough to say I need a drink, you know. It didn't matter. Good, bad, or indifferent, I needed a drink. Something about this world made me nervous. I'd be nervous about something, about anything. If I didn't have anything to do, I'd be nervous. If I had something to do, I'd be nervous. You know, whatever it was, it was making me nervous. And so when you get sober, you know, that nervousness doesn't necessarily go. So I would have a tendency to go with my sponsor and be concerned about stuff that I'd be thinking of. You know, it says, the wrongdoings of others fancied or real, real or imagined. You know, it doesn't even have to be real stuff. It could be imaginary crap that you think is going to happen. I'd go up to my sponsor, Joe Snyder, and he'd quote Psalm 46. I didn't know it was, you know, when you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I drank in bars. You know, I drank in bars. Trust me, in the bars I was drinking in, they didn't say any of the crap we say in Alcoholics Anonymous. None of this first things first, you know, let go, let God. None of the slogans were going on in the bars I was drinking with, okay? Nobody was quoting scripture. You know, none of that stuff was happening. There was other stuff going on. And I'd go up to Joe, and I'd tell him about my problem, and he'd say, hey, you quote Psalm 46, be still and know that I am God. That's the quote. That's what the Lord says. Be still. And then as he got older and I got older, he'd say, he would shorten it. I'd come up with a problem, he'd say, hey, just be still. And then by the time when he was getting ready to die, I'd go up to him and he says, just be. You know, I mean, he kept on shortening it, you know, for trying to figure out. And you know, I wanted to do that deal, but I just didn't know how to do it. I remember seeing a book by the White Eagle Society, you know, non-AA literature, and it was a little blue book and it said The Quiet Mind. And I had to grab it, I had to read it, because I had never you said the quiet mind. It might as well have said, you know, flying like a bird. I had never experienced a quiet mind. I figured if I read this book, maybe that would do it for me, okay? Somehow quiet my mind down. You know, the book of Ecclesiastes says this, this great line by whoever you believe wrote it, whether it's King Solomon, says, vanity, vanity, all's vanity. It's all about me and how I look and who I am and what do you think about me and that kind of stuff. My big book calls it selfishness and self-centeredness, being selfish and self-centered, and that's that deal. So I'm gonna go back a little bit in trying to explain about this God thing. A lot of people talk about God. You know, there's a line in here where it says in chapter to the agnostics. You might miss this if you read it quickly. It's in chapter to the agnostic somewhere, and it says something like this. I sort of marked it down. Let me see whether I can find it. Let's find chapter to the agnostic. Here it is. It says, this is on page 45. Let me tell you what it says. You know, remember, what did he say? Page says, she does the deal. She's doing the deal. So this is part of the deal. It's part of the deal. It says, well, this is our big book. This is our basic text, okay? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. This is what it's about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem, which happens to be your brain. You know it's your brain because you're not drinking, you're still here, right? Okay. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. See, let me read that again. I got to read it again. Sometimes you read it a second or third time, it'll sink in. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. That's exactly what this program is about. It's not about the fourth step. It's not about the fifth step. It's not about the 12th step. It's not about the step series. It's not about any of the steps. You can do the steps till the cows come home if you don't get this part. If you get to the end of the steps and you don't have a relationship with God, you've missed the boat. You're not doing the deal. You know, you're just punching numbers or doing your time or saying, you know, just one more day or, you know, that's it. You're not doing the deal. You're not going to get the rocket ship ride in the fourth dimension of existence. You're not experience much of heaven. You're not going to get what these guys got. This is the deal. It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. That's exactly what it's about. That's exactly what it's about. Do you know, I got to tell you something. I'm going to tell you something. I want you to try this out for yourself. Pick a part of the book, a paragraph, just some paragraph somewhere, and read it 10 times. Read it slowly 10 times, and you'll understand what the entire book is about. But if you read the entire book, you won't understand a thing. If you read the whole book, you won't get anything. Just pick one paragraph and read it 3 or 4 times, and you'll get it. You'll understand it. You'll see God is throughout, infused throughout this entire book. It's all about God. Well, that, I'm going to prove it. I'm going to read a few more paragraphs. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourselves, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, we are going to talk about God. Here the difficulty arises. So I want to tell you a few things that I sort of learned in my 33 years of hanging around this place, which may sort of explain some things to you about this improving your conscious contact with God and why it's so important, why it's so necessary for somebody like me. You know, they have a line that we say in AA, and I think it's part of the program. It says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious. Of true happiness, he'll find none at all. I want to talk about precarious sobriety. You know, Garrett asked me on the way up here, he said, you know, he says, what do you mean when you say precarious? I say, so I was thinking, I didn't have my dictionary with me. I said, well, precarious is like shaky. It's like you're on a cliff and you could go either way. It's like shaky sobriety. Shaky sobriety. And I want to talk a little bit about the difference between precarious sobriety and solid mature sobriety. Building your house on the sand or building your house on a rock, however you want to take it, however you want to talk about it. And to explain that, I want to explain a little bit about what I've seen in my life during the last 33 years as I've done this thing, sort of like in shorthand, try to put it in a short sort of deal. One of the things I learned about myself during the last 33 years is that although I'm an alcoholic, because I could not stop drinking alcohol, because I was powerless over alcohol, I've learned that alcohol, you know, and that drinking alcohol was a symptom of my dis-ease, because I was diseased, I was restless, irritable, and discontented, unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Although I had that deal and I'm an alcoholic, what I've discovered is that I'm addicted to a lot more things than just alcohol. Yeah, a lot of stuff, you know? Now, one of the problems with understanding this is when you're arrested for DUI, or when bad things happen to you when you're an alcoholic, when society screws you because you're an alcoholic, it's sort of easy to understand that it's a bad thing and you're suffering consequences. But when you screw up your life because you love money, or you screw up your life because you have to constantly have sex, or you screw up your life because you have to have pretty things, or you're constantly thinking about, you know, stuff, not only doesn't it seem like an addiction, but you look around, even at what we would call non-alcoholic people, you look around at the world we live in, you look at the TV set, you look at the movie stars, you look at the Emmys last night, and it seems like it's all good, because everybody's doing it. And everybody's happy, right? All the movie stars, nobody committing suicide, everybody's just happy with the stuff. So I tell a little story, and I told it before, and I'm going to try to speed it up. I tell a little story which I think is apropos of what my real alcoholism really is, and it's the story of the Camaro story. A lot of you have heard it already. Most of you have. I told it early on in this deal where when I was 16 years old, I got a hold of a Playboy magazine, you know, and I read it, you know, and I realized, this is before I started drinking, I realized what would make me happy. I realized exactly what would make me happy, okay? And I knew if I had one of them bunny things, I would be happy for the rest of my life. Now, there's something about, we got guys in here, right? Now, I don't think about girls and how they feel, but I have a feeling it's the same sort of deal. There is something about walking into a bar with a gorgeous woman on your arm and all the guys looking at you that makes you feel that you're not a piece of crap. That makes you feel better to be with somebody who's like good looking. You understand what I'm saying? You don't realize that that's part of the sickness. You don't realize that's part of the disease, that you need something on your arm to feel good about yourself, because without something on your arm, you feel like a piece of crap. All you know is when you don't have something on your arm, you feel like a piece of crap. And when you have something on your arm, you feel good. It's like when you're not drinking, you feel like a piece of crap, but when you're drinking, you feel better. Or it's like when you have a Rolex, you feel good, but when you don't have a Timex, you don't feel so good. Now, you don't look at this as like some sort of addiction or some sort of problem. You know, all you realize is you're always charging up your credit cards, you're always buying, you're always trying to prove, you don't realize that's a problem, you understand? Because everybody else is doing it, it just seems like it's living life, and that's the way life is, all about material things. You know, in the 12 and 12, it says, in the sixth step, it says things like, it says, we don't want to deprecate material things, but nobody's made a worse mess of trying to live by money, property, or prestige, or romance. Focusing on those things. So the Camaro story is simply this. I'm going to fasten it up, make it faster. I had a little savings, about $6,000 or something like that, and the Camaros came to town, was 1971 or 1970 or something like that, and they were absolutely gorgeous. And I knew, somehow men sort of know that if they have a nice car, they can snag one of them gals. You know, it has some for the, it's like when you're driving a nice car, it makes you feel better about yourself. And so I went and I took all the money I had down and I bought one of the first Camaros in Dade County. I brought it out of Potampkin Chevrolet. And I wanted to grab it and they said, no, you got to wait till tomorrow morning. We got to prep it. No, I'll take it without prepping. No, you got to wait. So I came that Saturday morning. I grabbed the car, you know, they gave me the car. Brand new, 100 miles, that new car smell, it was absolutely gorgeous. Gold with a white Lantau roof. I got in that thing, I hit Alton Road. It was Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, not a soul in sight. Not one person on the street, deserted. I'm driving that car, I got the window down, I got my hand out the window, a cigarette in the other hand. You know, I'm driving with my head or something. I don't know. I'm just so cool. It's unbelievable. I'm like frosted, okay? Just waiting for some. I just knew that all the women in China were looking at me through Google Earth or something. I don't know what was going on. Just waiting for people to sort of look at me. You know what I mean? I stop at a light. Some guy drives up in a brand new Cadillac. Some old fart like me. I'm a 60-year-old guy, you know, with gray hair, drives up in a brand new Cadillac right alongside of me. Now he's looking down at me, and I'm looking up at him. And in his car, right next to him, is the Playboy Bunny. He had something I didn't have, money. Okay, but in any event, he was probably a nice guy. I don't know. Nah, he was an idiot. He's a jerk. Okay, so the Playboy Bunny. So here I am in my brand new Camaro, and I'm looking at my brand new Camaro. I mean, 3 minutes before that, I was on top of the world. You couldn't touch me. I finally made it. I was okay now. I was better than, okay? Drinking had nothing to do with it. This was like drinking. This is as good as drinking. You understand? This is incredible. I'm on top of the world, okay? I see a few people nodding. This guy, I'm looking at this guy, he's looking at me, I'm looking at him, he's looking at me, I'm looking at the blonde, he's looking at me, and I say to myself, why can't I have a Cadillac? The feeling lasted 3 blocks, the payments lasted 36 months. That, my friends, is the story of my life. Before, during, and after. Looking for some person, place, or thing that's going to make me feel that I'm okay, that I'm as good as, that I feel okay with myself. Because what I really am is I'm a nothing. I'm always going to be a nothing. I used to put something in my body. It turned me into an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world. Now, there came a time in my life. So all I'm doing is I'm running after the money, the women, even after I got married, beautiful gal, really a beautiful gal, beautiful life, beautiful family, beautiful child, beautiful house on Miami Beach, on the golf course. You want to know something? You know, it was the Camaro. I went to a bar, I saw another gal, she was better looking, or maybe not better looking, but different. You know, why can't I have that gal? Why can't I have that? Why can't I have that job? It didn't matter. I had a great job. Division chief, prosecutor says, good job, nice job. He says, yeah, but why can't I have that other job? There was nothing I could possibly gain on the planet Earth, which after 5 minutes of acquiring it, I didn't get tired of, and I was looking for something else because I wasn't satisfied to make myself feel better. And the only thing I was chasing after, vanity, vanity, all this vanity, is stuff to make me feel better. And nothing worked, but what best of all was alcohol. So I drank it and I became what we refer to as an alcoholic. After I stopped drinking, on January 25th, 1981 was my last drink. I stopped drinking. But you want to know something? The other stuff, the other deal, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious, of true happiness will find none at all. You know that other stuff I was talking about? Guess what? It didn't stop. I was still staring at the gals. I was still staring at the cars. I was still staring at the money. I was still staring at the jobs. I was still staring at the stuff. And going to AA meetings. Now, the good thing about AA meetings is you read the book, they talk about God. You say the Lord's Prayer at the end, that talks about God. You say the Serenity Prayer, you know, at the beginning, that talks about God. Every once in a while you hear a guy talk like me and he talks about God. It's all sort of good. It all sort of makes you feel good. It made me feel good. And then I'd walk outside the door, and then for the next 24 hours, except when I was sleeping, I'd be chasing the stuff. You know what I found when I was, because here it's very difficult to have an hour with God and then spend the next 12 hours chasing the shit. You know what I'm talking about? What I would find is that when you're out there chasing the stuff, because you're addicted to the stuff, but you don't know you're addicted to the stuff, and if everybody tells you you're addicted to stuff, you say they're stupid. It's just like when people used to say to you, you're addicted to alcohol, and you say, go to hell. You know what I mean? You know, you don't like people telling you have an alcohol problem. You don't like people telling you have a stuff problem. Because you like your stuff. You know what I mean? You like your car. You like your stuff. So what happens is when you're chasing after the stuff and you're in AA and you're sober, what happens is every once in a while you got something called anxiety. It's because you're going to lose some stuff, or you're not going to get some stuff, or you need some stuff. You know, it's about money. It's about property. It's about romance. And so what happens is when you get into a real tizzy about not having your stuff and you're 3 years sober or 5 months sober or 6 years sober, you run to an AA meeting and you grab your sponsor, or you go to a discussion meeting and you talk about the stuff and how you're worried about the stuff and what's going to happen with your stuff. And what happens is what the good sponsor does and what the AA book does, everything, it somehow, some way, doesn't even talk about your stuff. You know what they do? They start pointing to God. And you sort of shake your head. He says, yeah, God is great, but what are you doing? I can't pay the mortgage. God, and they start saying things like, why don't you try to help somebody else? You know what I mean? Or, you know, what does it say in the form? They start pointing to spiritual stuff. And you know, and the truth is, if you want to stay sober and you want this deal, what will happen is you'll sort of like go along with the deal. You'll go along with it. You just sort of go along with it. You follow, somebody said it, you follow directions. You know what I mean? And it seemingly works, but you're so addicted. I was so addicted to the stuff, you know what I mean? That even though it would work, I would be out again out the door, and 5 minutes later, I'd be chasing the stuff again. It'd be some other stuff. It'd be dressed a different way. It would look differently. It all looked different. It was all dressed up differently, but it was all the same thing. It was all, instead of focusing on God, focusing on the stuff. And every time I'd come back to my sponsor or come up back to AA or any of that like that, it was always about the stuff. You know, there's a line in the Bible, you can't please God and mammon. You can't focus on God and money, God and women. You know, my sponsor used to say, hey Russ, underneath every skirt is a slip. You can't, what, now I'm not supposed to have sex? I mean, what, now, I mean, that's, I'm living for that stuff, you know what I mean? You can't do that, you know, but of course you don't want to talk about that in AA, it'll get people nervous, especially the ones that are living for that stuff. Living that so they can get sober, so they can get that stuff. What happens is when you live a life, when you continue to live a life, that kind of life, a material life, the selfishness does not go away. See, that's the real problem, the selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the real basis of our problems. It's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. We step on toes of others, they retaliate. All the bad crap that happens in your life, the bad crap you get yourself involved in, the consequences come from selfishness. Selfishness. It says, we must get rid of selfishness or it kills us. And says, God makes that possible. Apparently, focusing on God makes that possible. Not focusing in on the Cadillac, focusing on the girl, focusing on the job, does not cure the deal. It makes it, you ready for this? What I found is it makes it worse. It makes it worse. But what happens is when you're dealing with a hard-headed, defiant, alcoholic like me who is addicted, who lives in a certain amount of denial, I want to figure out how to do this deal and love God and be spiritual, you know, not religious, but spiritual, and somehow have the stuff too. You know what I mean? I mean, is that too much to ask? You know, be Hugh Hefner, you know what I mean? Or be a movie star and also have the stuff. And have the stuff and also, like, be a God guy. Is that possible? I mean, it should be. I mean, don't tell me it's not, you know? So that's what I want to do. Now, what happens is you can try that deal. You try it out. As a matter of fact, guess what? You will try it out. Guess what? You're doing it right now. And you will be doing it, because we're all going to go through the same deal together, okay? You're going to try it out, and one day, some of you turtles, you turtlets, the ones that make it to the water are going to have 30 years, and you're going to be saying the same speech I'm saying right now to people that are looking at you like you're crazy, you know, like deers in headlights, they can't believe it, you know? So I'm at a meeting one day. And the guy says, I'm 3 months sober. And a guy does a meeting named Dal Kennedy. Incredible. Incredible. I can't remember what he said, but he was just incredible. He had about 35 years. And, you know, it's like when these guys, after you hear him talk, you know, I mean, there was something that happened, something clicked, something, you know, it was just different. And he left the meeting. I turned to my sponsor and said, man, that guy was incredible. And my sponsor said, you know, he's dying. And I looked at him because I didn't even understand what he was saying, because it was like a non sequitur. I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just said to me. He says, yeah, he's dying. I said, what do you mean he's dying? You know, I've been to enough discussion meetings to know that, you know, alcoholics who are dying don't do meetings, you know what I mean? And, or at least they talk about it. And he said he's dying of cancer. He's got 3 months to live. The guy was dying of cancer. He had 3 months to live. He just did a meeting, didn't even mention it, and just tried to help other people. I said, he didn't even mention it. He says, I know. He says, he's dying. 3 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. So I'm looking at this guy, Al Kennedy. And my vision, you know, like it says, vision for you, as to what this thing was all about, where I thought it was just about not drinking, I was scared shitless of everything, you know what I mean? Dying was just one of it. You know, a lot of things I was scared of. I was always in fear. And I'm watching this guy with 35 years, and he's dying, and he's doing a meeting like I'm doing a meeting tonight. How do you do that? How do you have cancer and do it? How do you do that? And I'm looking at him. I remember Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to go a few minutes over, okay, if you don't mind. And, I mean, if you have to leave, you can leave. I understand that, you know? So I watched this movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. How many people have seen that movie? There's a part in the movie where Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are being chased by a posse. And they are doing everything they know how to do to get rid of the posse. They're going through streams. They're going through valleys. They're covering their tracks. And no matter what they do, the posse keeps on following them. There's some guy in front of the posse keeps on following them. And Butch Cassidy is looking at them through glasses, you know, the binoculars, and he turns to the Sundance Kid and he says, who are those guys? He says, I can't do that. Can you do that? I can't do that. I can't. How can they do that? With amazement. That's how I looked at Al Kennedy. I was like amazed that a guy who was dying of cancer, I mean, what is that? You know, what is that? I saw people in Alcoholics Anonymous do things and live their life in such a way I didn't understand how they could do it. You know, I mean, how can you be at peace with yourself with all the crap that's going on around you? It would drive me crazy. And it would have been a short drive because I was crazy. You know, and every time I'd get upset and I'd come into AA and I'd talk to my sponsor or I'd be on the phone, he would point me towards God. Every sponsor I had, every time I got upset, he'd point me to the big book and something, or he'd point me to the Bible. He'd point me to the 24-hour book. Every person in AA that I went to, every mentor, no matter what they told me to do, somehow it involved not worrying about the thing or the stuff and worried about it was about God. And more, I found myself at 5 years, at 6 years, at 7 years, at 8 years, less and less focusing on the stuff and more turning towards God. I mean, I wish I could say to you, you know, it's like you take the third step once on your knees and you say the third step prayer and then the battle is won, you know? I wish I could say that. All you do is just take the third step on your knees and then you don't have to worry about anything. No, you take the third step, you throw in the towel, and then you get up and you rip the towel back again, you throw off strips, you know, and hoping that'll satisfy the son of the gun. You know what I mean? And at 10 years sober, 10 years sober, doing steps, it means like I'm doing right now, I'm still focused on the stuff. At 15 years sober, I'm still looking at the stuff, worrying about the stuff. Not as much, but still, whenever I'm worried, whenever I'm concerned, whenever I'm a thumb-sucking crybaby, whenever I have anxiety, it's all about the stuff. And I'm not going to say that it ever completely 100% goes away, but I'll tell you what happens. What happens is, as you go along this thing, you let go and let God, more and more of that stuff. Turn more and more towards that deal, the deal, Him. God, see to it your relationship with Him is right, and see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know what it says in the book? Here's what it says. Maybe this will make it even clearer. Here's what it says. It says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We don't trust the money, the property, the prestige, the girls, the boys, the romance. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? We don't apologize for God. We don't apologize for God. In the book, it later on says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. Established on this footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, the quiet mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, conscious of God's presence, because we're always focused on Him. We're not hanging around with the guys that are talking about the gals. We're not talking about the guys that are talking about the cars. We're not talking about hanging around the guys that are talking about anything else other than Him. As we become conscious of His presence, we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter we were reborn. You know, and I could read tons and tons of things in the book over and over again that says the same exact thing. The central fact is this and nothing less. Our Creator has become the central factor of our lives. We are convinced that He lives in our hearts in a way which is indeed miraculous. He is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. But you want to know something? I wish I could say, all you have to do is read this book, listen to me, and you got it made. You're going to have to learn for yourselves. You know how I learned about life and focusing on life and focusing on stuff? The same way I learned about alcohol. Alcohol was faster because when you're addicted to alcohol, it takes you down faster. When you're addicted to coke, it takes you out down faster still. When you're addicted to crack, it takes you down faster still. When you're addicted to sex, not so fast. Sort of like a slow death. When you're addicted to worrying about why he has more stuff than I have, why I don't have a bigger house, when you're addicted to things, it takes you down real slow. You can go for your entire life just living a life of quiet desperation, being miserable, and not even realize you're screwed up because you're addicted to stuff. You can go through your whole life and never live your life, be dead, because not but realizing that your God is the stuff. Trust me, every living person on the planet has a God. Sometimes God looks like a car. Sometimes it looks like a woman, sometimes it looks like a man. Every person, let me tell you something, you're an alcoholic, you're gonna focus on something. It's either gonna be your job, it's gonna be your bank account, it's gonna be some gal, it's gonna be some guy, you're gonna obsess and focus and worry and suck your thumb and complain to your sponsor and complain to your group about something. But the thing is, what I found is every time I go to my sponsor, but you get beaten into submission. That's what the seventh step is all about. Where it says we learn the value of suffering, how we get a new perspective, by 100 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. Every time we're beaten down, every time we're crushed, Every time we realize the car ain't going to do it, the women ain't going to do it. Every time we realize that, we're pushed towards that deal where we have to rely on God. You ain't going to have the job. You know what I mean? You know, a friend of mine just got fired. I said, okay, you don't have the job. You're just going to have to trust in God on this one. You know something? Because you can't worry your way into a job. You're going to have to trust that God, you know what Marilyn said? She said the enemy started attacking her. At 7 years, he was attacking her, saying, you're not going to make it. How are you going to make it? You had 4 years, you got five. You know what God said? He says, you're just going to have to trust in me. You know, he says, when you're weak, I'm strong. You just trust in me and it'll be okay. You know, that was her relief. That was her relief. You know, a chip ain't going to do it for you. A sponsor ain't going to. You know what? The ultimate thing, it's going to be God. And any good sponsor is going to talk, point you towards him. Because at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you're sucking your thumb and you're worried about the money and you're worried about the mortgage, you want to know something? Your sponsor ain't going to be there. You know? And sometimes you're just not going to get the material things. And what happened is, slowly but surely, over a period of time, which is the way it works, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, with me mostly slowly, as time goes on, I more and more turned away from that deal and more towards him. So now what? I've got 33 years, it'll be 34 years. Is it perfect? Not perfect, but it's pretty good. So I probably go to more AA meetings now than I ever went before. Only this time when I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, it's not because I need a meeting, although of course I need fellowship in meetings, it's because I want to see whether there's any way I can help anybody else get what I have. It's like Bill Wilson said. You know what he said? He said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease. I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. That's why Al Kennedy was at that meeting, even though he was dying of cancer. Because the Lord had been so wonderful to him, curing him of this terrible disease, it didn't matter he had cancer. He had to tell other people how incredible it was. You know, because that's real mature. That's a mature sobriety. And so what happens now? So now, what does it say in the book? The book encourages church membership. I'm not telling you should go to church, but I started to. I started to go to Bible study. What would you expect? A person who is turning more and more towards God, focusing more and more on him, wanting as much as him as possible in our crazy society, where would you expect him to wind up? In the Playboy mansion? You know, in some car lot somewhere? Where else would it, you know, I mean, sometimes you hear people putting down churches and things like that. I don't know, that's not AA. That's not the AA I was brought up in. The AA I was brought in not only encourages church membership, you know, maybe one day you'll be well enough to be able to join one of those. It says we lose all prejudice even against organized religion. We begin to see where they're right. But some alcoholics never get past that. They're like the turtles, you know what I mean? They never get past the pride. And all I can tell you is the more I focus on him, the more I focus on God, the more my faith is assured, you know, like the double mind that he is there and he's going to help me, the less I worry about what year my car is. The less I worry whether or not I have a scratch in my car or not. The less I worry about, you know, some person's moods or my boss's moods or what my bank account looks like. Now, I'm not perfect. I'm a human. I live on the planet like you do. I have kids. I have a wife. I have, you know, grandkids and all that sort of stuff. But you know something? I went to the doctor. I don't know. I went to the doctor one day. He told me I had cancer. I said, thank you. I went out and did another meeting. You know what I mean? I don't know how it happens. All I know is that when you focus on him, like I believe is what the book wants you to do, you stop losing concern about yourself, obsessive, compulsive concern about yourself and your own well-being, and you start beginning to be more concerned with other people and how they're going to do. And I can't explain that to you. And you're not nice to other people, and you don't try to help other people because you feel you have to. Because you feel, well, I've got to do this because this is AA. You do it because you're compelled, because you want to do it. There's a big difference between being forced to speak at a meeting or being forced to serve people or forced to help people or feeling you have to do it because it's an assignment and wanting to do it, being compelled to do it because you want to do it because it makes you feel good to help other people. And that has to do with focusing on him. That's all I can tell you. All I did is I started focusing on him. It wasn't my idea. You know, blame John Glenn, my sponsor. Blame Joe Snyder. Blame Bob Sullivan. It's those guys. It's this book. It's what this program is about. Focusing on God. And you just go ahead and you read it yourself and you tell me what you think it's about. So I'm just praying that all of you get it. I know a lot of you are. I heard some of the birthday people. That's what this deal is about. So thank you very much. God bless you.